Welcome to Talking Energy, the UK Energy Research Centre podcast.
Hello, I'm Rob Gross, the director of the UK Energy Research Centre. Today we're going to be talking about the energy crisis, price of energy, and all of the issues that are facing us for the coming winter. I'm joined by two extremely well-known colleagues and experts in the energy sector. Charles Hendry, former energy minister, regarded by many as the best informed and most likeable energy minister that we've ever had, and are now still active in the sector, vice president at the Energy Institute, and an extensive kind of interaction and engagement with the energy industry throughout. And Dr. Joanne Wade, who's the chief strategic advisor at the Association for the Decentralized Energy, also with a huge amount of experience in the sector, also a council member at the Energy Institute and the chair of UKIRC's research committee. Charles has a CBE for all of his good work on energy, and Joanne has an OBE for her services to energy efficiency. Welcome both. Thank you so much for joining us. We're going to be talking about the situation that confronts not just the UK, but countries around the world, particularly Europe, as a result of events in Ukraine, the high prices that were already present in the energy sector prior to that as a result of the kind of demand supply mismatch post-COVID, and the way in which we are trying to tackle this and how other countries are tackling it, particularly our near neighbours, and the differences in policy. Now, when we were setting up this podcast, I think we had one prime minister fewer than the number of prime ministers that we've had thus. And there's some uncertainty again over exactly what's going to happen with energy policy for this winter. But I think I'll start by asking the kind of the big picture question, which I'm gonna throw at Charles initially. What do you think should the government be doing, or what needs to be done to help us get through the coming winter?
Rob, thank you very much for having me on, and delighted to take part in this event. So we're running out of time, frankly, aren't we? So that there's not much which can now be done to help people through the winter, which is unfortunate because we've had warning signs for many, many months, even a year or so out, and more could have been done to address issues such as energy efficiency, and to ensure that those who are most vulnerable would be able to get through this winter more. I think in the time available now, that there's a limited amount. First of all, I do think more information would be useful. People say the government should do this. I question that. I think the people don't always trust their governments, and I think it would be better to do that through local authorities, through fuel poverty action groups, through organisations like Martin Lewis and people like that, and to give people advice on how they can reduce their consumption, but without just turning their heating off. So finding ways in which they can reduce their costs, reduce their consumption. The other thing is, I still think we need to build up a sense of like the COVID community spirit, where everybody looked after their neighbour. And I think as we go into a very difficult winter, then we all need to be looking after our neighbours. We need to be making sure that the elderly person next door has warmth, has food, and isn't going without food in order to keep the heating on, that we have something where we can all contribute, because the scale of the challenge is bigger than something which government alone can do. And government won't know the individual households which are going to be most adversely affected, but the councils will have a better idea, the energy suppliers will have a better idea, and we as individuals do. So having something which actually ensures that everybody is being watched over, being looked after, I think is going to be an important part of how we help people through what's going to be a pretty difficult winter.
Okay. Joanne, do you agree with all of that, or anything else that you would add?
Hi, Rob. Yes, I mean, I do agree with what Charles has said. I think I would add on his point about some collective community action. I think that's going to be key. It's the only way we can do this now over this winter. But I think we also need to think beyond the individual looking after their neighbours. I think we need to think about what people need to be able to use energy efficiently. So it's all very well a public information campaign saying, make sure you draw your thick curtains when it gets dark, make sure you draft strip your windows. If people haven't got thick curtains and draft stripping, they can't do it. So we need warmth banks as well as food banks. And people need to come together to make sure people have those bits of infrastructure that they need in their home to make their home as efficient as it can be made over this winter. Charles is right, we can't do anything major on efficiency before the winter hits us, but we can help people do the small things which will add up to really helping. So we need to see that.
So I'm quite interested that you've both really focused in on things that we can do to help our neighbours, who people might or might not trust, energy efficiency in the home. So I know that we haven't got a time machine, but do you think there was a wasted opportunity during the course of the last 6 months over the summer to have galvanised a bit more energy efficiency action? Joanne, you're nodding.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, why? Why have we not had a major information and energy advice programme over the summer, like most of our European neighbours have had? Why have we not had national calls for us all where we can safely and healthily use less energy? We should be talking to the people who can afford their energy bills and saying, turn your heating down a bit. We should be talking to people about driving more slowly and less, so that nationally we're actually using less energy, which of course then has an impact on the price, the less we collectively use.
So why didn't we? Charles, what do you think?
I'm afraid it was a political decision at the end of the day. A decision was made that to focus on other aspects of energy security. And I think they missed an open opportunity to make a real difference to many vulnerable people this winter. We do know where many of those people are because the councils have lists of vulnerable households and the energy companies do. And so it would have been quite possible with some central government funding to arrange for somebody to go around to all of those homes and to say, what can we do? I've talked before about changing to low energy light bulbs, and people say, well, that won't make much of a difference. But you know, we save 10-15% of our own energy bill at home by making sure all of our light bulbs were low energy. And that there would be things which could be done, which would enable people this winter to be warmer, and that opportunity was missed.
Political. I mean, I'm quite interested in, and I'm going to just explore this a bit further. Then we will move on. I find it quite hard to understand what the political opposition is or was, because we probably don't know it now what the current position is, to information provision or doing the kinds of things that you've just described. Joanne, what do you? This isn't the politics show, so we're not going to try and do party politics in particular, but there's clearly something that the government feels is kind of nanny state. Do you think it's that? Or
I mean, on one level, it's quite beyond me. You know, I really don't understand on one level because it's so obviously the responsible thing to do. However, I think there are possibly two things. One is information is not free, and information alone just shoved out there is not terribly effective. So you can imagine we'll spend money on this, but will it really help kind of argument going on. I can imagine that happening. My response to that would be, if you give advice, not information, if you do what Charles said and send people into people's home and say, how can we help? That's different. And secondly, the cost to our National Health Service this winter, the cost in terms of productivity when people are ill, those costs are huge compared to how much a proper advice campaign would cost. So I think it's a false economy. The second thing that I think might have been going on is this idea that maybe people don't trust government. So is government, Charles, you mentioned it earlier. You said, you know, perhaps national government isn't the way to go in terms of giving people this information. That doesn't stop us having a nationally coordinated, nationally funded program that is delivered through trusted community leaders. So I can see two possible reasons, but I don't think either of them are valid.
Charles,
I'd agree with that. I agree with that entirely. I think that there was a sense that some people said, well, this is nanny state and we don't like that. I think that was misplaced. But I think also there was an anxiety that when ministers started doing this, the interview would turn around and say, well, come on, you live in a big house, you've got a big income. How on earth can you relate to the problems which people are facing? And so the issue to me wasn't whether it should be done, it was who was the best messenger. And if we had galvanised the CAB, if we had galvanised Martin Lewis, if we'd done it through National Energy Action, organisations like that and local councils, then I think we would have been able to get a lot of help to people. And it's very clear, just listening to radio programmes, people still don't know what difference it makes to to their costs and to their actual energy usage by switching when they use things or by what you turn off, how long do you leave it off for. And that sort of expert independent advice, I think, would have been valuable to many, many people. It's not too late to do that. We still can do that. We can't do the big energy efficiency rollout, which I think Joanne and I would have liked to have seen, but we can still help people by managing their household demand.
I think that's a really interesting point, isn't it? Because very many, you know, for some people, probably even the basic information, turning off your mobile phone charger isn't really going to make any difference to anything, but turning the heating down by a very relatively small amount really can. And that cuts both ways, doesn't it? Because there could be things that people are kind of desperately switching things off that actually won't make an awful lot of difference to their energy and maybe suffering as a result. Okay, so there's quite some consensus around, you know, what hasn't been done and what might have been done differently, thinking about consumers and households. What about the price freeze? What about the kind of the kind of really unprecedented fiscal intervention that we're now seeing to keep household bills, or the price of energy, hence household bills, below a certain threshold? Was it the right thing to have done?
I think it had to be done. I think the government needed to act urgently. It was made more difficult because for some months we didn't have a functioning government, and therefore it had to be done with some degree of urgency and in a way that perhaps was less targeted than might otherwise have been if it had been planned more carefully. But nevertheless, I think we've got a measure in place now which will help people. Doesn't make it an easy winter. It's still going to be a difficult winter, but it removes, both for households and for businesses who are facing closure in many cases, it moves the immediate threat. We'll need to see where we get to after the winter and whether it needs to be extended, and that I think it may well need to be, but at least we've now got people know how bad it can be, rather than just seeing that there's bills going up and up and up and not knowing how they could possibly pay them or where it would end.
Joanne?
Yes, I agree with Charles. I think it is a shame that it couldn't be more targeted, because I do think we have to acknowledge that even at the level it's been set, there are a lot of households who can't afford that, more households than we've ever had before. And it's unfortunate that more of the help couldn't have been targeted towards those households. But given the situation we were in, I think it's probably the best we could have had, and it's needed desperately.
Okay, so I think a kind of inevitability or an unavoidability around having to have done something, both socially and macro, in terms of, you know, the impact on the inflation rate and all of those other things which we're aware of. What about other kinds of intervention? What about price caps, upstream price caps, wholesale market interventions? We're seeing that we had a UKIRC idea that was to get all of the existing renewables and nuclear under a long-run fixed price contract, which got some traction with the government and was mentioned by the Prime Minister. Now they're saying they're going to do something slightly different, a price cap of some form on electricity from renewables and nuclear, which is also across the EU. The Commission has given countries permission to do that. Some countries have gone further. The French government's done a deal with the big electricity provider EDF to keep bills down. The Spanish and the Portuguese are intervening directly in their markets. Some people are even saying we should cap the price of gas. So upstream price interventions. Charles, maybe this is more in your wheelhouse than Joanne's, but I'm interested in what you both think about this.
I think we need to look at all such options, and I think the UKIRC paper is extremely helpful in that regard. So what's the best way of doing it? I think there's pros and cons of every different approach. I think it's very difficult to find a single measure which would work right across the sector, and it's going to have to be targeted quite carefully. So, for example, the very old onshore wind farms, for example, which were subsidised under the RO, that they are making extremely large amounts of money, whereas those which are under the CFD are actually paying money back already. So that depending on where people came into the process, then it depends on whether they are making what we would all consider to be excess profits or not. If you're a gas peaking plant, then you're paying a lot of money for the gas. So we need more evidence as to see what the profit element is in that and to whether action needs to be taken in those areas. But I think people are expecting that in a difficult winter, everybody makes their contribution. Everybody does what they can to help. And I think that's a matter of social equity and as much as political necessity.
Joanne, do you want to add anything? Or
yeah, I mean, Rob, as you said, it's not really my specialist area here, but I do think the whole situation very much brings home the bizarre way that, for example, our electricity prices are so closely linked to gas when actually there's so much, an increasing amount of electricity that comes from other fuels. So what we need to tackle that, it really brings home that we need to start separating these things and reforming the way we price things. And I think from a public perception point of view, when you're seeing excess profits all over the place in the system, it does raise a question in people's minds as to why we're not acting at that supply end of the chain to constrain these prices. So I think from a non-specialist point of view, it seems to everybody that something needs to change.
So Charles, you're the kind of arch pragmatist, if that's not a contradiction in terms. I think you've said something along the lines of, you know, that the normal thing is for the government to be involved in energy policy, and the exception was the brief period when they very much weren't. So is that kind of just writ large now, do you think? So, for example, I was reading a letter that a lot of the big energy firms and Energy UK had written to the former Secretary of State, saying that the energy bill had too many special powers, it was going to discourage investors. Do you think, is that right? Should we be expecting a time of crisis the government will kind of take charge of things? Or should we leave it to the market?
You can't leave energy to the market. This has always been my concern for those who say that we should, because that it's just simply too important. And at a time when we were awash with gas and everybody wanted to build gas plants in the UK, then yes, to some extent that was possible then. But now we also want to decarbonize, and government has to give signals as to what is the relative importance between security of supply, decarbonization, and affordability. This government has to be directly involved in this. I think what spooked industry when they saw the details of the energy bill was this, what's called the Henry VIII clause, whereby it gave ministers sweeping powers to override Ofgem. And I think that you've also got to balance confidence in the sector. And it was clear that that measure was going to be very damaging to industrial confidence and to future business investment, which we badly need. And therefore, I think the government would be sensible to review that again and to take out that clause, which was never intended or never expected to be in the bill.
So does this worry your members, Joanne? I know you're not the big energy companies. You're the decentralised end of things.
I think the idea that government can just override the structures that are in place for regulating a sector would spook anybody that's involved in that sector, large or small. I think the key thing is that historically, regulation has been very slow and can stifle innovation if you're not careful. And I think the idea that you're trying to come up with a mechanism that enables a bit more fleet of foot response to situations, I get that, but I think our members would say the same as the large energy companies. It's not about government saying we can just run roughshod over everything, because business need a certain amount of certainty. They need flexibility and they need the ability to innovate, but they also don't want the idea that the rules can be thrown up in the air at any minute. That's not helpful to any business.
Yeah, the whole point of having an independent regulator is to avoid the kind of concern, at least, or perception that political reasons would cause intervention in the energy market. And I guess we've seen the financial markets teaching the government a lesson at writ large, that the institutions that they've put in place, whether it's Ofgem or the Bank of England or the Office of Budget Responsibility, actually really, really matter to what's perceived to be good governance. I think we could have a separate podcast about the changes to the governance of the energy sector and the role of the regulator, the role of the new future system operator and all of that. But let's keep on this coming winter. So one of the things that I quite often get asked by journalists and others is, will the lights go out? You know, how serious do we think it is going to be? And how do we make sure that doesn't happen? I'll ask Joanne, what's your view on that first?
So, I mean, we always have this scenario. You know, we've always got a scenario. What happens if we get very close to the lights going out? That's part of National Grid's job to do that. So I think the fact that they've got that scenario isn't to me, particularly concerning. However, we are in a more difficult situation this winter than we've been for a long time. So I think it's something that's very sensible for us to be prepared for. What I think's really interesting is that it's leading to things like National Grid saying we want to encourage households to be flexible with their energy use. We want to involve consumers in making sure this doesn't happen. You know, so the incentives that are now going to be provided to households to time shift energy use, I think that's a perfectly rational thing to do, a very sensible thing to do, but also a very interesting thing to do going forwards, because we are going to need to be more active consumers as we go forwards into the energy transition. So actually doing that this winter, when it might help avoid the lights going out and getting people used to the idea that they can be active, not just the energy system happens to them, I think is good. And I think it's starting to enable us to make better use of our homegrown energy sources. It's making the system more efficient. It will eventually exert downward pressure on prices. So being prepared for supply constraints, getting consumers used to the idea that they might have to respond to avoid the lights going out, I think is a really good idea.
All right, Charles.
Joanne's absolutely right. I mean, this is a part of the planning which goes out into getting ready for every single winter. And National Grid are required by law to look at what the challenges and the risks are. And they're not saying that they expect this to be widespread, but they are saying that there'll be the greatest risk will be on a few hours of a few days. So in that evening peak, when people are coming home from work, when we've all got to have the lights on, we've got to have the heating is on. And then at those points, we're going to find that there will be a great deal of pressure on the system. But they've also said that this would only really happen if something dramatic happens. So either it is unexpectedly for a prolonged period, or, for example, if there was an interruption to the gas supply which comes in from Norway for whatever reason. And so I think they're right to say that we should be aware of it, because it'd be much worse to find that this happened and they hadn't warned us, but they'd already known about it as a potential risk. I think the growing consensus is that we should be able to get through this winter without interruptions, unless something big and unexpected does happen. But we need to recognise that in energy terms, we are not an island. We are very interconnected through electricity and gas connections to continental Europe. And what goes on there will impact what happens in the UK. And so that we do have a lot of ways of getting gas into this country. We can get some more out of the North Sea. We've got the lines from Norway and elsewhere. We've got good LNG facilities. And I think the government's been looking at how it can make sure that we've got the LNG available to bring into those facilities, even if they have to pay a high price for it. And so everything is being done, I think, through the government's energy security strategy and its task force to try and address this and to make sure that we can come through this winter. But I'm afraid it highlights decisions which I think were made historically and which got this wrong. And before I went into government back in 2010, I tried to amend the then Labour's Energy Act to require more work on gas storage. When I left government, I worked on gas storage when I was in government. Even when I was leaving Parliament, I tried to amend the Conservatives Infrastructure Act to do more on gas storage. And on both occasions, I was blocked by government. Well, if we had procured more gas storage, even 7 years ago, 2015, when I was doing this, that would be built now. And instead of just having a handful of days of gas storage, the UK would have 2-3 weeks of gas storage. We can't do anything about that at this point, but we do need at some point to look back and say, what decisions did we take collectively as different governments over a long period of time, which added to our vulnerability at this point? And the argument which was used at the time saying, oh, you don't want to put extra costs on people's bills. Well, we should have looked at this like household insurance. We don't pay insurance on our homes because we want to get burgled or for the house to burn down. But we want to say that in the event of some catastrophic event, we are protected and we get some help. And that's exactly the same what this would have done. So I think that we will need to go back and to look at a whole range of decisions which were made and to say that did they help or did they cause greater aggravations.
So LNG, I'm sure most listeners know, but liquefied natural gas, which is the gas that comes in on tanker ships rather than pipeline. I think, and there's a question, isn't there, which again, perhaps we don't have time for now, around as we transition away from gas over the longer term towards net zero, more renewables and other zero carbon options, what the role of the gas infrastructure that we've got will be. But I'm interested in our relationship with our near neighbours, because if you mentioned Norway, another non-EU Western European country with their own oil and gas reserves. And you mentioned the rest of Europe, effectively, so the EU countries, and we have an interconnected, both gas and electricity markets are still interconnected, irrespective of the UK's departure from the EU. Are we working together collaboratively enough? Should there be a Western European security pact? Joanne, I'm outside your wheelhouse again, I know, but any thoughts on that one?
Yes, I think it's been quite disturbing to hear the narrative around we're an island. There has been a certain narrative around we're an island, and as long as we've got enough of our own energy resources, we'll be okay. There has been that slight feeling going on. And that's, to me, completely the wrong way of going about things. As you say, we're very interconnected. But also, we're not just interconnected in an infrastructure sense. We're interconnected socially with the rest of Europe. So the idea that we're not playing our part and contributing to the whole of Europe dealing with this energy problem, I find, like I say, disturbing. Our efforts to reduce energy use, our efforts to manage energy demand better, will help not only us, but our neighbours. And I think that's where we should be.
Okay. I mean, depending on what happens with the maintenance issues on some of the French nukes, we could easily find that in a windy winter, we would almost certainly be exporting our electricity through to help them out. So, Charles, what's your thoughts? Are we doing enough to collaborate?
That was what was always intended, is that when one country has excess power and it can export it more cheaply to the other, then that should be happening. And that benefits both of us. It gives us both the opportunity, both us and the French and continental Europe more generally, the chance to benefit from lower prices. So this is an integral part of a functioning energy system. And that we may want to look at other things this winter. I mean, should we actually, instead of being 1 hour different from the French, move to being 2 hours different from the French? Because that would then shift the evening peak. And so you then tend to find that in the evening, that when the French have their peak, that we're putting electricity through the interconnector to them, and the other way around later on. So when we have our peak, so if we spread that out, and so you reduce the overlap, just even for a short period of week, would that make sense? We've got to be very pragmatic. And we've got to look at a whole range of different solutions this year in order to help us get through. And at the same time, as Joanne's saying, I think we're in violent agreement on absolutely everything today, that at the same time that we need to be looking at how we build that cohesion across Europe to give us greater strength, because this will fall apart if we manage to secure our own interests and to find a way in which we can be all of the electricity, all the gas that we need, and at the price which we want to pay. But there's a crisis in the rest of Europe. That will not work. That will be a disaster for the continent when we're all trying to stand together in the face of Russian aggression. And that we need to ensure that where there are real pressures, that collectively, whether we're part of the EU or not, we're working collaboratively to try and deliver the best solutions.
All right. We're running out of time, so I think I'm going to make this the last question. This winter, we've already, I think, agree, there's no question it's going to be difficult. And I know that neither of you have, well, none of us have a crystal ball, but beyond this winter, would you expect that things will be improving, or we just don't know, or getting worse? Charles?
Well, I think this is the first time there's been a real sort of international energy challenge where the solution is, how do you get off oil and gas? How do you decarbonize faster? And if we're looking ahead to the next winter and the winter beyond, then in that time, we need to accelerate the rollout of renewables. We need to accelerate the rollout of energy efficiency to give us greater security. And we can do that. And I think, therefore, that means not just offshore wind, because that takes a lot of time and a lot of investment, but also doing more on onshore wind and making sure that we accelerate that, and more on solar. So yes, there are solutions which we can deliver. The next few years, I think, could be a little bit squeaky, but I think at the same time that people will respond well if they see that there's a real program for action which is going to deliver lasting change and lasting benefits. And huge advantage of that at the moment is that those, as Joanne was saying, those low carbon solutions are actually better for the consumer in terms of costs than relying on traditional hydrocarbons. So we need to see a step change in that level of investment.
Okay. And Joanne?
Yeah, I would totally agree with Charles. You know, I think all those non-fossil resources that we can develop, hugely improved energy efficiency and also more demand flexibility, all those things will make us better able to cope with each winter as we go through. And I think the key thing is not to treat this as a one-off crisis that may, you know, if we keep our fingers crossed, have disappeared by this time next year. We don't have crystal balls and we need to be prepared. And the more that we can move our investment in the right direction, the more prepared we will become each year.
I think we might leave it on that note. So I'm not going to even attempt to summarise everything that we've been discussing. But Joanne Wade, Charles Hendry, fascinating stuff. And thank you both very much indeed for joining us.
You're welcome.
Pleasure.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about UKERC, you can visit our website at www.ukerc.ac.uk.